Here's an article in the mid-November San Jose Mercury News. After police used tear gas, suspect found dead under home. Officers went to residence Wednesday night after a woman called to report her boyfriend had assaulted her. A domestic violence suspect who barricaded himself inside an Almaden Valley home for about 14 hours overnight Wednesday, a couple Wednesdays ago, or at least maybe last Wednesday, twice resulting in police deploying tear gas in an attempt to force him out, was found not breathing and later died at a hospital, San Jose Police Chief Eddie Garcia announced Friday. It was not immediately clear if the tear gas was a contributing factor to the suspect's death, Garcia said Friday at a news conference. We're still wondering about that. I guess Trump is wondering if the Saudi Arabian prince had something to do with the death of Khashoggi, the Washington Post journalist who was dismembered in the Saudi Arabian embassy in Turkey. Wondering goes on. The Santa Clara County Medical Examiner Coroner's Office will determine the man's cause of death, a process that could take weeks. And, of course, by that time, who's going to care? However, Garcia said police had reason to believe the suspect, identified as 51-year-old Mark James Spencer, may have been under the influence of narcotics at the time of his death. I see. So, really, it wasn't their fault that they killed him if they did, because he was under the influence of narcotics. And he was, anyway, probably a bad guy, you know, so let's move on. The ultimate cause of his death, quite honestly, was not him not coming out of the house, Garcia said. But those chemical agents that are introduced are meant to be an irritant that absolutely assist us in preserving life. This is a real quote, believe it or not. In this case, the subject refused to come out, and that was ultimately his demise. So it was his fault that he didn't come out because the toxic gas that the police sent in was simply an irritant, you see, that any reasonable person would have come out. Goodness knows why he didn't. Probably some kind of a junkie or something, or maybe he was afraid of being shot. I don't know. Not with the San Jose police, no. Garcia said tear gas is not considered lethal force, is widely used in the law enforcement community, and has safely ended many confrontations. Of course, he doesn't give the stats about how often it's resulted in any fatalities, or he doesn't deny or doesn't claim that it has never resulted in fatalities. Since December, the San Jose Police Merge Unit has responded to 8 incidents and used tear gas on 3 occasions. The decision to use tear gas during a situation was made by the chief. The situation unfolded about 9:15 p.m. Wednesday when a woman called police to say she had been assaulted by her boyfriend in a home on the 6700 block of Elwood Road, located near Amadon Expressway, south of Camden Avenue. When officers arrived, they learned Spencer, quote, was not going to be cooperative and had 2 outstanding felony arrest warrants for domestic violence, assault with a deadly weapon, and terrorist threats, Garcia said. Police also learned Spencer was known to be in possession of a handgun, even though prior convictions barred him from possessing firearms, Garcia said. Patrol officers surrounded the house, called for Spencer to surrender. At one point, Spencer momentarily stepped out of a side door, refused to comply with the officer's demands, and walked back inside the home. We aren't learning anything about any kind of dialogue that went on. There are no other witnesses being quoted or cited in this article by Jason Green and Mark Gomez, but I continue. Eventually, police called in their specialized units, including their merge, also known as the SWAT team. All efforts to verbally convince the suspect to exit had failed, and after approximately 14 hours, instead of officers entering the residence and forcing a possible armed confrontation, chemical agents were introduced in an attempt to force the suspect to come out. A short time later, officers entered the home and heard movement beneath the floors. They ordered the suspect out, and after no response, police used another round of tear gas. Officers eventually went beneath the home and found Spencer unresponsive, that is, dead. Officers provided CPR and first aid to Spencer. He was taken to a hospital. He was pronounced deceased at 12:35 p.m. Thursday. Well, maybe he wasn't dead when they took him. City Councilman Johnny Comas, who represents a district including Almaden office, said his office has received dozens of complaints regarding the house where the standoff took place. He said neighbors have complained about drug dealing and other criminal activity. We've had problems with this house for more than 4 years, said Comas, adding he had worked with police and the Santa Clara County DA's office to remedy the issue. There was a lot of illegal activities, drug dealing. The neighborhood was up in arms several times. Comas said neighbors also did their part, provided police with license plates of vehicles associated to the house that would come and go. prosecutors and homicide detectives are investigating the death. The case is being monitored by the police department's internal affairs unit, the city attorney's office, and the independent police auditor, who I'm not sure if they, I think by this time they've, the previously independent auditor has, I'm not quite sure how independent she or he was. Auditors, I've always found, generally are much weaker than police review boards, which are all themselves very weak because they don't go about subpoenaing police and doing their own investigations, but tend to take it from the cops and then see if they have to cross any T's or dot any I's. Anyway, this was after police used tear gas suspect found dead under home. It could be, you know, perfectly legitimate kind of police action. But, I mean, I notice, again, the lack of any independent reporting. Well, there is some mention that they're telltale things, like they pull out this the drug history. They pull out, we don't have any witnesses or any kind of comments from the relatives of this guy. I don't know. Anyway, you have it. You can make up your own mind. You hear my bias, which is pretty blatant. I'd like to see one more independent reporting, and also, I guess it's, you know, you can't expect police to wait forever if it's been, as they claimed, what? How many hours did they wait? Having trouble finding it in the story. 14 hours is a long time. I don't know. This concern with officer safety when you have all these bulletproof garments, and he hasn't. There's no indication that he showed a gun. The fact that he may have had a gun. So they push in gas that could be. Well, they're claiming, in a way, inferentially, that he really killed himself because he declined to come out, indicating they knew that if he didn't come out, it was likely to kill him. And that's maybe one of the reasons that they feel the gas is effective, also because it probably feels like shit, so to speak. Anyway, that was that for our defendant, or our suspect. And we don't know who was responsible for going into who were the actual killers in this case. The gas men who killed Mark James Spencer. The police chief is given the ultimate responsibility, Eddie Garcia. But there, I don't know if he may have been on the scene, but I suspect it was. I doubt it was the police chief himself who stood there and released the gas.
Welcome back. We are joined now by America's UN Ambassador, Nikki Haley. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Many of us are perplexed, to say the least, by President Trump's recent UN address, particularly the ominous threats he made to, quote, totally destroy North Korea. What the hell was that?
Well, I think what you saw yesterday from the president was he was being honest.
Maybe that's why we didn't recognize it.
I know that, you know, people and countries don't want to hear it, but here is a man who continues to threaten our allies. He says he's going to destroy the United States to ashes.
Yeah, but enough about Donald Trump. Let's talk about North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, who the president has been taunting recently, both on and off social media, with the nickname Rocket Man. Do you really think that's a good idea?
I will tell you that, look, this is a way of, like, you know, getting people to talk about him, but every other...
He always takes to Twitter just to grumble, grouse, and gripe. He's having fun, but Kim Jong-un is not the playful type. I'm slightly more than panicked that this schmuck is gonna wipe us off the map by acting like a baby. He's playing cat and mouse, but he's the mouse among these men. He fires up his fan base with his talks at the UN. I'd rather would he behave more presidential? But again, he's acting like a tiny little baby. And though I know his followers are thrilled, he's gonna get us killed. How do you solve a problem like Korea? How do you sleep when missiles start to fly? How do you not have constant diarrhea when all of our lives depend upon this guy? Many a name you know you'd like to call her, but certain things are better left unsaid. 'Cause how can you do the trick with childish rhetoric? How can two tiny men have such big heads? How do you solve a problem like Korea when you're a crazy dotard?
Dotard.
Dotard. Or a dotard, I'm sorry.
All these men.
Rocket Man is on a suicide mission for himself. The United States is ready, willing, and able.
It's gonna be a long, long time. The touchdown finally brings him back to fight. He's got the man they think he is at home. Oh no, 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 no. He's a rocket man. Rocket man, running on his fuse out there alone.
Kim Jong-un saying he takes President Trump's threats personally, so he has been rattled.
I think it's gonna be a long, long time till this dude finally does something right. We think this tiny brain would finally grow. Oh no, no, no. He's a rocket man. Rocket man, gonna start a war with his phone.
They will be met with fire and fury,
the likes of which this world has never seen before.
Oh, Jesus.
How do you solve a problem like Korea? How do you get them not to drop a bomb? How do you calm their autocratic leader?
Just tell him his hair looks dumb and go, your mom.
Trust me, that shit always works.
Why does your mouth have constant diarrhea when you're supposed to be a diplomat?
Your imbecilic insults could have apocalyptic results. Just tweet him and say, hey Kim, your ass is fat. Done.
Oh, how do you solve a problem like Korea?
And by the way, Rocket Man should have been handled a long time ago. Little Rocket Man.
Girl.
Not like that.
Rocket Man.
Dotard.
And that was, of course, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Korea? A satire of the Sound of Music song, How Do You Solve a Problem Like Maria? It was a year ago, at least, the fire and fury threat by Fuhrer Trump. And since then, of course, there have been peace negotiations, peace talk, and some peace actions, mostly between North and South Korea. Although, here's a bit from the antiwar.com website, U.S. South Korea to scale back spring exercises. Though officials had previously been threatening a return to large-scale military exercises in South Korea, the Pentagon has once again agreed with South Korea to dramatically scale back a major exercise, in this case, the spring 2019 war games. This is Full Eagle, which is usually one of the major Korean war games for the U.S., and usually a big source of tension with North Korea. According to Defense Secretary James Mattis, it will be scaled back enough that it won't threaten ongoing diplomacy. This may prove controversial, as General Robert Abrams has recently told the Senate that the reduction in war games was degrading the readiness of U.S. military forces inside South Korea. Between that and some not being on board for North Korea diplomacy in general, this may see some resistance from our rocket heads, as I might like to call them. It is unclear how the U.S. and South Korea decided to scale this particular exercise back, how they did it, though usually such actions have come at the behest of South Korea, who both has more to lose from foiling diplomacy and has made side deals with the North to prevent any incidents fueling tensions. And there's also two Koreas connecting the DMZ road. Since the 1953 armistice of the Korean War, all roads within the demilitarized zone, DMZ, have been severed. On Thursday, for the first time, that was, I guess, last Thursday, since then, a single road will be reconnected by the two Koreas. South Korean officials describe the road as unpaved and in Gangwon province. The two sides will coordinate on this first road connection as part of recent deals to improve tensions. The Koreans remain technically at war, you know, since 1950. I mean, how ridiculous can you get? I guess it's a lot of fun and games and profits for the military-industrial congressional complex that is getting huge amounts of money and profit out of all this, but not particularly for the Korean people, who would like to be reunited, I imagine. But since I'm straying from Santa Cruz, let me stray up to the north, and let's listen in on an interview I did a couple of days ago with Jim, who is with the successor to the First They Came for the Homeless encampment. It actually is one of the First They Came for the Homeless encampments, which is right next to the fenced-off area, which surrounds the area where the First They Came for the Homeless used to be. And this encampment, actually they called themselves Here There, the First They Came for the Homeless encampment in this place. The First They Came for the Homeless, of course, gets its name from the speech by Reinhold Niebuhr, who in Nazi Germany famously said something or wrote something like, first they came for the socialists, but I was not a socialist, so I did nothing. First, then they came for the gays, but I was not gay, so I did nothing. And finally, when they came for me, there was nobody to do anything. First they came for the homeless. Here's Jim talking about what's going on up there. Sounds like an improving scene with campgrounds making connections with each other, which is something I've suggested happened down here in Santa Cruz. In fact, that was one of the topics we discussed at the last Conscience in Action meeting yesterday, and probably be talking about it at the next HUF meeting on Wednesday, which is coming up on the 28th, I guess it is. So check us out at the Sub Rosa at 11, between 11 and 1, and join in the discussion or come and see what we can do to make sure that people who are outside don't freeze out this winter, don't get driven away by police, don't get involved in or be ravaged by a hepatitis A epidemic because of the closing of the bathrooms and the refusal of the city to provide elementary sanitary services, sharps containers, etc. Let's listen into this interview.
So it's about 20 to 3. That's the sound of the BART train passing by. And I'm walking along the, gosh, I don't know, is it iron? Some kind of metal painted black, I don't know, 7 foot high fence with spikes on the top of it, which used to be the Here There, First They Came for the Homeless campground, and still in the cloth letters, it's Here and There is posted on the fence, and then inside there are large, I don't know, 10 foot high word Here. And as I walk along the path, I see colored tents between the path and the roadway at Lyon Street. The place is no trespassing, no camping. Here in our presence is a gift to give thanks for the chalking on the sidewalks. 13 tents I count so far, 14, 15, and more. 16, 17, 18, 19. First They Came for the Homeless, a large banner on the fence on the other side of the sidewalk.
I'll put this down so I'm not distracted. I'll go outside and
no problem.
Smoke a cigarette.
I'll come with you and sit in the chair because I'm tired. So this looks like the living room here.
We have two living rooms. This is the smoking living room, non-smoking.
I gotcha. So we're talking with?
My name's Jim Squatter.
Hey Jim, how long have you been with First They Came for the Homeless?
Since we were down at the post office on and off.
That's a long time.
Yep.
And I was here, I don't know, what, 2 months ago maybe? Like briefly here before, and I guess that was around the time when authorities dumped one of the other protest encampments from the city hall. And that was a couple of, about 2 months ago, 3 months ago.
Right, okay. Well, since then, those people came here. What's more exciting now is we've started to network with the other camps that are in Oakland, and they filed a temporary restraining order similar to what we did, the village in East Oakland. And so now they have the police backing off in Oakland. And we're in network with another encampment that's out in West Oakland. And they were harassing them, and all of a sudden now they're sort of backing off from that as well. And so it looks like the temporary restraining orders get them against all the cities. It seems to tie them up, at least for now.
Now, is this after the Martin versus Boise decision?
It's subsequent to that, this filing is. Ours was before that ruling had been issued as a final ruling. So I think now both our judge and probably the judge of this new case, who I've heard is a much more progressive judge than our judge.
His name? Your judge's name?
Our judge's name is Judge Alsop. Their judge's name, I don't know. I can't.
Alsop, the milksop, or would that be inappropriate?
I think he's a Clinton appointee. He's fairly supposed to be, you know, left of center. He's a Ninth Circuit.
So was Jesse Arguin, but look at him.
Right, exactly. But this new judge.
Jesse Arguin is the so-called progressive mayor of Berkeley, and he's anything but progressive, but particularly notorious because he made a lot of noises sympathetic to homeless people in order to get elected, but ain't that always the way?
Seems to be much more progressive, and seems more activist. He's saying he's going to issue a ruling in 2 weeks on the TRO as far as if it's going to go to trial, which is much faster than our judge acted on it. The other thing that's really interesting is this is in state court. A state court has given back a homeless person their vehicle that was towed in San Francisco for tickets, etc.
I think I heard about that. Go ahead.
Yeah, and so now there's some RV dwellers in Oakland had their vehicles towed. I believe Ocean Newman here at the law clinic has taken some of those cases on, I believe. So it could be that maybe in East Bay we can get the same thing where, look, if you're homeless and they can't tow your house away.
Well, I know that, I guess it was, I'm thinking of Amanda, an activist who was with the kind of the, I don't want to call them the wharf vehicle folks, but folks whose vehicles were parked down.
Oh, and yes, yeah. I don't think I can say this on the radio.
Okay, hang on, we'll go off for a record here. Here goes that Bart again, hang on. So, it's Jim?
Jim, yeah.
You told me that I'm Robert again.
The entire camp is situated right next to this elevated Berea Rapid Transit train line, which provides regular conversational breaks, if you will.
Told me that there, your connections with other camps, this camp's connection with other camps, may ultimately result, in the not-too-distant future, with the takeover of the site both for ground camping and for vehicular camping.
We're working towards that. We don't know how it's going to turn out at this point, but it is definitely one of our goals. We've been talking to another encampment and another nonprofit on two different sites that we're looking at possibly taking over. Take care, Ron.
So, how many camps, I know it's hard to estimate, but first of all, how many camps do you have connection with now? This first, the camp for the homeless camp. You're thinking it over.
Six or seven.
And are these both wet camps and the clean and sober camps?
Yes. In fact, eight camps, yeah. What we've found is that the camps that are the most well-organized seem to be clean and sober camps, and that's spreading as an idea now.
Of course, wet camps, terminology that I first heard when it was used with regard to rainbow gathering encampments, which happens, well, the main rainbow gathering happens once a year, and there are smaller rainbow gatherings, which are sort of a countercultural gatherings. In the United States, they go to different states each year, and people come from all over to gather and meet and spend weeks together in one of the national forests or some such federal land. Wet camps are places where people can go who are alcohol users or drug users. Dry camps are places where it's understood you aren't to use those kinds of substances during the duration of the time you're there. So,
but people are starting to realize, hey, if we have these rules, then it makes this more functional. Also, people are starting to really understand the parts of anarchism where if we work as a functional group, it's much better than a king of a leader or, you know, any of the other various malformed styles that come out.
You mean you're not a Stalinist?
I would say not. It's my saint, Emma Goldman.
Emma Goldman. You and the Kronstadt sailors, eh?
Yes, and the Machnovis.
Ah, yes. What about somebody from the 70s or 80s or 90s? Do we have any new heroes?
At the intellectual level, he's been around forever, but Noam Chomsky still is doing a pretty good job of laying
it. I'm voting for Clinton Chomsky, that guy?
I didn't catch that one, sorry.
I said, Noam, I'm voting for Clinton Chomsky.
Well, okay. I think he's a fool for that, but whatever.
It wasn't so much that he voted for Clinton as that he urged others to vote for Clinton, and he campaigned
worse.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, he saw Trump as the worst alternative, although...
You know, I've been an anarchist since the early 80s, and each time a right-winger comes to power, some of my newer anarchist friends are like, no, but you've got to vote this time, save the nation. I'm like, you know, I don't think that's probably what's going to do it, so I'll keep my vote to myself, thanks. But I think if we work on this other stuff half as hard as we work on that stupid electoral shit, we'd already be there.
What kind of work is being done to further connections between camps? Do you guys have meetings? Do you have potlucks?
We have both, in fact. There's every Friday at the Omni, which is an anarchist collective of collectives, big building here in Oakland. We have a meeting at 6 p.m., reaching out to the other camps.
Open to the public, or?
Open to the public that lives... Open to the public that lives sans domicile.
Outside.
Yes.
What about housed but sympathetic would-be reporter?
Reporters, it would be okay to be at the meeting, but we don't want you to record it because we're planning direct actions frequently and that sort of thing. So it's we like friendly media, but just don't blow us up.
Take it. So this is a kind of a relatively new development. This connection between the camps has only recently begun, right?
It really started when
this camp used to be on the other side of where the fence is. When they chased us out of there, we realized, look, if we set up multiple sites, we're more flexible if they hit us at one or two of them. So we've had Old City Hall here and Aquatic Park that we set up all simultaneously.
City Hall was removed, but Aquatic Park remains?
Yes. Although it's less, it became a wet camp. So they're struggling with those issues.
But you're still maintaining connections with it?
Yeah, we send them food and, you know.
Do you still have meetings at the Omni and otherwise?
Oh, the Omni, that's a series of meetings. It's been going on now for about a month and a half or so, 2 months. And our main contact now is the village, which has evolved several times. They had a negotiated deal with the city that the city welched on in Oakland. And so...
tell me about that if you can.
It's pretty well covered in the East Bay Express and online, but basically they set up a camp with the same type of rules we did, and the city of Oakland kept dumping homeless people there and pushing homeless people there. They had several fires, they had a dead person, you know, somebody died in their tent, that kind of thing. They died for some reason in their tent, but wasn't discovered for days. These kinds of problems, because they just kept... So some of the original people that started that have found this new site in East Oakland and filed the TRO. And so that is a good step, you know. Also, God, I forgot, there's a camp done by Lake Merritt that we did some demonstrations and artwork and stuff to back them off. There's one out in West Oakland, Wood Street. Familiar with Mutiny Radio over in the city?
Tell me about it.
Mutiny City started out as a pirate radio station, and I think they are streaming now also. And they may have got, I think they still may have a unlicensed, you know, transmitter.
I know San Francisco Liberation Radio used to be around in the 90s.
Yeah. I knew Radio Free, and I knew, what's his name? The guy was making a little transfer.
Dennifer.
Yeah, Stephen Dennifer. I haven't seen him in forever.
I haven't either. I remember when I last saw him.
Yeah.
So you were kind of itemizing the camps and possible future actions that are coming up. Anything coming up that you want announced on the radio? This will be broadcast on the radio, on the stream of free radio.
At the moment, but I'm telling you that there's going to be a very broad movement that now is legally establishing the right to exist. That's what I call it. With these temporary restraining orders, with the vehicle stuff, we start to put these pieces together, and it's like, look, don't mess with us. We have the right to exist. Go find the crime and fuck with those people.
I've noticed a lot of tents, a number of individual tents around Berkeley, just sort of the different spots along Shattuck or side streets. Has that become more prominent since September 4th when that decision was announced?
It wasn't. Boise affirmed it, but we knew about Boise before it was listed, and there was another case down in L.A., and so in our TRO, we said, look, man, this exists in law. Let's start to enforce it. These people have a right to shit, to piss, to eat, to sleep, to do what human beings have to do to survive.
To cook.
Yeah. Yes, to cook. Well, that one was easy here in Berkeley. They were going to put in no cooking on the street, no flame on the street or anything. I pointed out, I'm one of the people that helped organize what became the famous flag burning case that went to the Supreme Court.
Tell me about them. In 1989?
The demonstration was 84. I think we got into federal court.
We may have missed some of that. Go ahead.
We got together. through the post office, but we knew each other, for some of us from Occupy, some of us from different movements. And I think Mike Zint was the person that really said, I'm going to make this about homelessness. We're all fucking homeless. And homelessness had not had traction as a movement for a long time. I was skeptical, but we did a good job. And we've resurrected it now, I believe. Well, I don't know so much as we've resurrected it, or the fact that there's shitloads of people with no place to live. I think resurrected it. Yeah. You get on to L.A., I mean, fuck. There's something like 75,000 people on the streets of L.A. I mean, it's a whole city in itself.
And you've been with this particular set of tents for the last couple of years at least?
Yeah, I went up to Oregon last year to go check things out and realize, you know what? Portland, it's expensive. There are a lot of homeless people. I was hoping to find a cheaper city. And yes, it was cheaper, but not cheap enough for me. And so I ended up essentially back here because of health problems and stuff. I had to come back for health care here. I'm going back up that way.
Any reports from Portland of any kind?
In Portland, there's some really interesting models. There's a group of homeless people that started out from Occupy, actually, and they got harassed and corralled, and eventually they landed on this piece of property that nobody quite knew whose, kind of like we did over there, whose property is it. And
you're not talking about Dignity Village or Dignity.
Yeah.
Because that was, what, long before Occupy, actually. They started that in 2002.
Dignity Village, it's the one right by the train tracks. It's Meg and
something for us or something.
It's Hazelnut Grove. It's called Hazelnut Grove. And they're just a group of homeless people that came together, got pushed around, went through all the kind of shit we did, and then finally found the spot, and now they have a tiny home village that's really all independently built and done, and with solar and showers, and they have their act together.
How many people are involved?
That actually live there, I'm guessing about 30, maybe 35, 25 to 35, someplace in there.
You don't get hassled by the cops much? Or?
Oh, they're like us, they're well past hassled by the cops. They're in negotiation with the city about how to, you know, like, we want utilities, they're not sure they want them there, but it's all negotiation, no police action. In fact, for a while they did have plumbed water from a neighbor, but my guess is something went wrong. But I saw there's a whole bunch of things. In Eugene, they have a program. I'm assuming it's a non-profit homeless program, but it's run like a restaurant. You go in, you get seated, they come and bring you food. It just doesn't have, the menu is limited. But yeah, they have servers, they come around, refill your water, and bring you more food if you want seconds.
It's a place like that in Portland too, as I remember.
Oh,
at least it was 15 or 20 years ago.
Well, see, I found up there St. John's something or other. It's a store, but there's no cash register. It's all food that's been donated, and they're open like 4 days a week, and you just come in. There's limits on what you can take, like, take, you know, unlimited some stuff, other things, we only have this much, so take this many of this. But I would say that you could do 80, you know, if you had a family and whatever, you could do 80% of your shopping there for free.
Anything like that in Berkeley?
Nothing like that in Berkeley. Nothing in the Bay Area that I'm aware of. What else did I see there? But yeah, there's a lot of cool models around the country of what's going on. Places now, I think in Southern California, are sort of the cutting edge of RV life and living in a vehicle life, because it's LA. got to have a vehicle. But they were the first people I know that got vehicles returned through the courts that had been taken. And they're now trying to set up sanctioned parking, living spots. Churches are talking about, we're talking about land, etc. Another cool model, as far as it's really functional, I like it, is Loaves and Fishes in Sacramento. And that's a great program as well. That's the best one I know of in California, as far as...
Well, you have the quarter meal here.
Yes, you have quarter meal, but if you're disabled and trying to get a meal in Berkeley, it's hard work, man. You have to get, you know, every day it's a different church, a different location, halfway across the city from each other. It's not convenient.
Is Newman Hall anymore?
Newman Hall, and there's other churches, you know, and there's the youth center, and you get a meal there, but there's not like St. Anthony's where you can go breakfast, lunch, dinner every day, the same damn place.
In San Francisco.
Yeah. There's nothing like that here. It's higgledy-piggledy all over town, one day a week, a meal, you know, figure out what the schedule is, where you got to get to.
I'm going to wind it up, but give you the last word as to whatever you think we haven't covered that we have covered, but you want to emphasize. And also, I guess First They Came for the Homeless has a Facebook page, right?
Yeah. First, so does this camp, is neither here nor there. We have Facebook.
Under what name?
Neither Here Nor There.
Neither Here Nor There.
Yep.
Okay.
Named after the famous Here There.
You're neither here nor there. You're just across the tracks from here nor there, and here and there, here or there.
Exactly. So we're neither here nor there. And then there's First They Came from the Homeless. And we're starting to set up websites and stuff, because who knows what's next, but I think we may have to get the hell out of here to find housing.
Because?
Well, as it burns down here in California faster than they're building it, and we already have this deep deficit, I'm thinking that housing might be a distant memory here for poor people. We may have to go to someplace else and hack it out of the forest and make our own home.
And we've been talking with?
Jim Squatter.
Thanks, Jim.